Thank you so much, Sam. My name is Sydney Sadowski, and I am an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank everybody, thank the committee, thank you, Billy, for asking me to come and share here. It's a privilege, and it is an honor always to be a participant in Alcoholics Anonymous in any way I can. And that reading, you know, made me want to cry because I always know where I'm supposed to be, that I usually read that first off when I start my share, because that's why I'm here. You know, I'm here today because of the grace of God. And what I want to talk about is how I established that relationship with my higher power, because I couldn't stop drinking. I wasn't, I was one of those alcoholics that is of the hopeless variety. And the truth is, without Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know that I'd be dead, but I know I wouldn't be happy. You know, I hear people talk about, I came to AA because I thought I was going to die. And the truth is about me, I came to AA because I didn't think I was going to. And I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought I was an alcoholic. I kind of got tricked into it. And if you would have told me that day that that was going to be my last day of drinking, I would have, you know, not done what I did. I loved alcohol. You know, I'm Polish and Irish. Therefore, I'm Catholic and alcoholic. It's just kind of like that genetic thing that runs in my family. My parents were not alcoholics. And are not alcoholics. They're both still alive and both still married. I don't know if it's a genetic thing. I don't know. You know, I get really jealous of people that I hear talk at meetings who say, when I was 12 or when I was 14 or when I was whatever, I took that drink and it was, changed everything. It's not my experience because I don't remember my first drink. My mom drank. I mean, I was born in the 60s. My mom drank when she was pregnant with me. She drank when she nursed me. When we were small, she put whiskey in our milk if we were fussy or we were sick. I mean, that's just, I grew up going to my uncle's house. I grew up in Portland, Oregon, in Salem, Oregon, but I would go to my uncle's house in Portland. And before we left, they'd give us all just a little bit of vodka so we'd sleep all the way home. So I don't have a conscious recollection of my first drink. But what I do know is my whole life I wanted it and I didn't know why. I knew where the vodka was in our house. There used to be guys that would come over. I was very young in the 70s, and these guys from Poland would come over with these bottles of vodka, and inside the vodka would be this, what they called buffalo weed. And I remember fighting with my brothers to get it. I mean, I was just willing to suck on a piece of straw with alcohol on it. You know, I mean, my mom would make these virgin drinks for us, and I didn't want those. I wanted what she was drinking. And it wasn't because I had a bad childhood. It wasn't because I think when I was older, I decided I had a bad childhood. Because that's what people told me, you know, the psychology and the therapy that I went to, I started, you know, finding out why I was the way I was, because it was somebody else's fault. What I know today is that I always wanted to drink, and then I went around looking for reasons why. I needed to find reasons to explain why I was living the way I was living. Reasons to explain why I did the things I did. But deep down inside, I knew there was something, there was just something that couldn't be explained in any other way. And it wasn't until my sponsor read to me from the big book, and there's a line in the doctor's opinion, it's the in between the letters part, and Bill writes, it explained many things for which we could not otherwise account. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous did. It explained to me what alcoholism was and what it wasn't, because I had no idea. I thought an alcoholic was somebody who drank too much, lived under the bridge, you know, got in car accidents, got DUIs, got all these things that happen to alcoholics. And that wasn't happening to me. I didn't have a lot of consequences as the result of my drinking, a lot of outside consequences. And one of those things that explained why I drank, when I was 16 years old, I was living in another country. My 15-year-old brother died in an alcohol-related accident. And I came home, and when I'd show up at a party, people would give me a drink. And I'd say, well, of course. And I was delighted to have a really legitimate reason to drink. And I drank. And I remember when I was about 15 years old, I had made a conscious decision that one day I would grow up to be an alcoholic, because I wanted to be a writer, and all good writers are alcoholics. And so I set my mind to it. You know, I started practicing my drinking, and because I didn't want to drink too much and then pass out and miss the party, you know. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was in college, in a little college in Southern Oregon, and I picked the college because it was known for its parties. So that's how I chose my educational path. And I met a girl there who was in AA. She was 18 years old. She was 3 years sober. And she was friends with my roommate. And I knew about this AA thing, and I knew kind of a little bit about the alcoholism thing. And I asked her, I would ask her, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And she would say, Sydney, I can't tell you that. You have to figure that out for yourself. And so by the end of the year, I was dying of alcoholism at 20 years old. I went to the doctor one time because my kidneys hurt, and my roommate suggested I see a doctor about that, which I thought was a little overreacting. I mean, come on. In the morning it was bad, but by the afternoon I was fine. So eventually I went to see this doctor, and I weighed 108 pounds. They couldn't draw blood. My veins would just collapse. And they didn't know what was wrong with me. And the doctor looked at me and said, how much do you drink? And it didn't occur to me to lie. I was very proud of how much I drank. It was a badge of honor for me. And I told him the truth. I said, I don't know, about a case or two, a beer a day. And he looked at me and said, do you think you have a problem with drinking? And I said, no, my kidneys hurt. That's why I'm here. I drink just fine. And that was the level of my insanity. There was no connection in my mind between my drinking and what was going on in my life. It was just that I couldn't ever hook up with the right guy. I guess that's not a term we use anymore. I couldn't get together. I hooked up with plenty of guys, but I could never get together, right? It was that relationship never worked out. The school thing just wasn't working out. I could never find the right job. By that time I'd already moved several times to different states and countries. I just couldn't seem to get any traction in my life. And what I know today is I was terrified all the time. I didn't know it was terror. I didn't know it was fear. What I thought it was, I didn't know. It was just the way it was. Just like my childhood was just the way it was. You know, I didn't know any better or any different. That's just how I grew up. That's just how I felt all the time. And I would get close to a deadline or get close to showing up for a job or get close to going for an interview. And this feeling inside of me was so uncomfortable. But I used that to propel me forward, right? I was the alcoholic who never missed work. I didn't miss classes. I did everything I was supposed to do. And it was that terror inside of me that drove me to show up. And I didn't know what any of that stuff was. But based on that, I had to drink every day. I had to drink every day because in drinking was the only place that I could find any type of comfort whatsoever. And so when I was 20 years old, I woke up one morning. It was June. It was a June morning, June 6th, 1990. And I called the girl across the street, Mel, who was the girl from AA, and I said, would you take me to a meeting? And she said, I've been waiting for your call. And she took me to this meeting in Medford, Oregon. It was in a Lano club. There were a bunch of motorcycles out front, guys with leather jackets on. And I was like, oh, I'm just this, you know, college girl. What am I going to this place for? And I walked in and I sat down. It was a podium meeting. And I don't know when it was, partly through this meeting, they asked if anybody would like to share. And I stood up at the podium and I said, my name is Sydney. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober about 8 hours. And then I just cried, which was awesome for the alcoholics in the room. They're like, yay, you're destroyed. That's fantastic. Yay. Which I was like surprised by that response. They gave me a big book. They put their phone numbers in it and they told me to keep coming back. And for some reason I did. I did go back to those meetings. And they told me to do a lot of things. They told me to get a sponsor. They told me to get a service position, which I did. I cleaned ashtrays. That was my service position. And of course, I thought that's just what you gave the newcomers. Like it was like a hazing kind of thing, punish the newcomers by making them clean the ashtrays. And I poured coffee and eventually I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was standing up at the podium and telling people stories about your life and how crazy it was. I didn't know what else to do. But I knew if I went to these meetings every day, I wouldn't drink. And I hung out with the young people and we did young people stuff, right? And I did get a sponsor. And she took me through the steps. We got to the fifth step and, you know, there's two things about this period of sobriety for me that explain a lot, which I didn't realize until later. The first thing was my sponsor asked me a question during my fifth step and I lied. And it wasn't a lie that I told on purpose. It was just the story I told. And what it says in the doctor's opinion is that, you know, our alcoholic life becomes our only normal one. You know, we get to a point where we can no longer differentiate the truth from the false. And that I didn't know which part of my stories were true, and I didn't know which part of my stories were false because I'd told those stories so long to explain things that it was all kind of real to me. But I knew that I had told her a lie, and I knew as soon as it came out of my mouth when I heard myself tell it. But I was too afraid to tell her the truth. I was too afraid to go back. And this is a woman who opened up her home and she had a little, you know, coffee and cookies there for me to do this fifth step. She did everything she could to make me feel warm and welcome and kind and loving. And it made me so uncomfortable how nice she was to me. When you were nice to me, it frightened me and I didn't want to go back. Because I had gotten to the point where if you were nice to me, I had to give you something. I owed you something. Everything was, I was keeping score. And that's just how I lived. The other thing was that they told me, I can't keep any secrets. And it says in the big book, if we are to recover, there can be no lurking notion that someday we'll be able to drink again. And for me, there was this thing in the back of my head that said, well, I can't go to Poland and be sober. I mean, how would you do that? Nobody in Poland is sober. You can't do that. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody my little secret in the back of my head. And after a year and a half of sobriety, I drank again. And what happened was I had moved from Ashland to Portland. I didn't get connected back in. I went to some meetings. You know, I didn't know. I didn't know what was a good meeting. I didn't know what was a bad meeting. I had no idea. I was just kind of doing it on my own. I made the amends on my own, which if you're new, don't do that. Discuss it with your sponsor first, because then I had to make amends for the amends I made. later on. But between 1992 and 1997, my life got progressively worse. I don't know, and this is something that I used to hear, like, if you start drinking again, you're gonna start off right where you left off. And what happened for me was the day I picked up a drink after a year and a half of sobriety, I had a pint of alcohol, a pint of beer at the airport. Then I had a six pack, and then I had three rum and cokes. And I was fine. I was fine. So, which is shocking to me now. It made perfect sense then. So my body was still capable of processing. I didn't get totally drunk, which you would expect from a, you know, underweight college girl. But I never drank daily again. It says in our book that you can tell if you're an alcoholic if you cannot stop forever or control the amount you take. And the truth is, I never tried to control my drinking. That didn't make any sense to me. It was like, why would I do that? And I didn't understand the stopping forever part, because I remember coming back to AA and saying, well, I quit drinking for a year and a half. I'm probably not an alcoholic. I could quit drinking. And in between 92 and 97, I moved to Europe. I tried to get sober again in London, and the same thing happened. I found a wonderful sponsor. She was this little German girl about my age, very nice, invited me to her house to start reading the big book. And I remember coming out of King's Cross Station and being terrified and having to use all of the energy I had just to go to her house. And again, she was nice to me. And I couldn't go back. I could not accept kindness. And I found out why that was later on. And when I came into the rooms in 1997, I was tricked. I did not come here because I wanted to quit drinking. I on Wednesday, March 26, 1997, I realized that I was hearing voices of people that were not there. And I was sober that day. And when I got home from work, I understood something was terribly, terribly wrong. I called my brother, he called the doctor, and the next day I went to a doctor's office. And the nurse came in and asked me what was going on, and I told her, I was honest. This is what I've been doing, this is how much of it I've been doing, and now I'm hearing voices. And she was like, okay, let me get the doctor for you. She was not expecting that level of honesty. And the doctor came in, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, maybe you should go to a meeting. And he gave me a schedule, and he told me to go to a meeting, and I went to this meeting. And it was in the basement of St. Paul's Episcopal Church on Liberty Street in Salem, Oregon, at 7 a.m. And I started going back to AA. And what I knew was, if I didn't drink, if I didn't go to a meeting, I wouldn't drink. But if I didn't go to a meeting, I probably would. And I didn't want to quit drinking, but I knew enough to know that if I started drinking, then all that other stuff was going to start happening too. And I had always wanted to be an academic. I, at this point, had one master's degree, an undergraduate and a master's degree. And I'd always wanted to be an academic. I'd wanted to be a professor. And I realized at that moment that I wouldn't be able to because I'd lost my mind. And I knew I was going to an institution. And so Alcoholics Anonymous was just like the door being cracked open just a little bit, that there was a possibility that I would be able to live normally. And so I was going to these meetings. And again, you guys told me the same things. Every time I came to AA, you said the same thing. Get a sponsor, read the first 164 pages of the big book, go to a meeting every day, get a service position, call other women in the program. It was always the same message, and thank God for that. But again, I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And you know, I don't think a lot of people in the meetings I got sober in were talking about the big book, and I don't think they were talking about the solution. I don't know, because I was completely nuts. But what I do know is when I was 9 months sober with a handful of diagnoses, know, bipolar, obsessive compulsive, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorder. I mean, you name it, I was schizophrenia. Like, you name it, I had it. And I was on pills for that and this and that and the other thing. And my sponsor said, you know, Sydney, if you keep taking a pill and putting it in your body, you're never going to give the steps a chance to work. And that hit me. And, you know, I don't recommend this, but because I was told don't make any major changes in your first year. And what I decided was, well, I'm going to go off all my medication and move to Los Angeles. And that's what I did. And I moved to LA. And once again, that terror was on me. I was supposed to go to a meeting. I knew I was supposed to go to a meeting. I had friends there who said, you know, it might be a good idea for you to go to those meetings. You know, they weren't alcoholics. They were people that knew me from college. And I remember going to my first meeting in Sherman Oaks and where my friends lived. And I just thought, it was huge. It was huge. And there were tons of people there. And it terrified me. And I felt like I blended in and I didn't feel any different. And eventually, I started going to meetings. But the kind of crazy head that I have, the kind of fear that rules me is that kind of fear that says, you can't go to a meeting because what if you can't find a place to park? And that's the kind of fear that keeps me from going to a meeting. And finally, I went to this meeting in Santa Monica. It was this little club in Santa Monica that people had told me about. And I was living in Santa Monica with one of my friends. And so I drove there. It was like a straight shot. It was down Lincoln. I lived on Lincoln. It was down Lincoln and then a left or a right. I don't know. It was away from the ocean. And I found this little place and it had a parking lot so I could park in the parking lot. So I got there early so that I could park in the parking lot. And I went in and I still just was terrified. But I knew I needed to get a sponsor. So eventually I got a sponsor and she told me I needed a service position and she made me be the greeter. And thank God that woman saved my life, because as a greeter, I stood there in front of that meeting every Saturday morning, terrified of you. I thought everybody knew everybody else. And I was here, this girl from Oregon, and nobody knows me. Nobody knows anything about me. By this time, I had a year sober, but I met this girl and she suggested that I go to this women's meeting. So I started going to this women's meeting on Wednesday night. And while all those people loved me and while all those people were kind and while I would go to this women's meeting every Wednesday night, I was working the program to the best of my ability. I was working the program as my sponsors had told me to do it. And I had gotten another sponsor and I was doing what she told me to do. But I'll tell you what the miracle that happened. I was going into the meeting one night. I would often go into this meeting. It was at a woman's house and her husband would be leaving as I was coming in. And he would say, "Hey, Sydney, how are you doing today?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, my boyfriend, blah, blah, blah." And he'd say, "Have you ever thought about reading through the big book with another alcoholic?" And my response would be, "Well, how's that going to help my boyfriend? Right? How's that going to help my job? How's that going to help me find a place to live?" Like, it just, I thought he was crazy. I'm like, "What are you even talking about?" You know, but he said it to me repeatedly. That's all he'd ever say. "Well, you might want to think about it." And he was very nice. Everybody was very nice. And when I was about just over 2 years sobriety, you know, once again, it wasn't working out. I wasn't finding the job. I wasn't working out with the boyfriend. And I moved back to Oregon because maybe it would be better in Oregon. And I went back to the meetings and I was going to meetings and I got my first sponsor back, the one who had sponsored me originally. And I got a guy and we got engaged and we bought a house and we got a dog. And one day he decided it was time to go and he left. And my life was shattered. My life was shattered. And I went to meetings as I had been doing all along and sat there and cried. And I thought that was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember walking into the backyard of this cute little house that I had was now the sole owner of, that I could no longer afford to pay for. And thinking to myself, I have a choice. I can either drink or I can kill myself. Because I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I had no idea what alcoholism wasn't. I had no idea what the solution was you guys were talking to me about. I didn't know. All I heard was people say they came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They had this horrible life story. This happened to them when they were drinking. And I would think, yeah, well, you know, if I drink, I can see why you drink. I mean, your life sounds horrible. You know, I get it. You know, I heard people say, just don't drink in between meetings. And I thought, if I could just not drink in between meetings, why would I have to come out and hang out with you people? And I thought there was something really, really wrong with me, something far greater than alcoholism, because I'm sitting in the meetings and I'm hearing people saying I quit drinking and my life got better. And I quit drinking and my life did not get better. Repeatedly, time and time again, I would kind of get it together. I would have periods of control, followed always by a worse relapse without drinking. And I remember thinking, why am I even sober? Why am I even sober? If this is as good as it gets, what the hell? Excuse me, I shouldn't have said that. I usually don't swear, but you know, I mean, like, really, why? What am I doing here? I'm hanging out with you people who are not my favorite people. I mean, like, what am I doing here? And there was a woman who had moved to my little town in Oregon. And at the end of this Friday night meeting, she'd always raise her hand, and she was really cute, blonde, just adorable, thin. Drove a little BMW, you know, like she had it together. And she'd say, I got to plug the steps. And I remember thinking, whatever, crazy lady, you know, I've got problems. And for some reason, I called her. I called this woman and I said to her, you know, I keep sitting in meetings and I hear people say that God will never give you more than you can handle. And I said, I cannot handle this. And she said, oh, Sydney, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because you've got it all wrong. Life will never give you more than God can handle. And when she said that, I felt like this, what I know today is hope, but it felt like this weight coming up that I could breathe, that I didn't have to handle anything because I knew I couldn't. I had been trying my whole life just to be better, just like it talks about in the big book, you know, better philosophy or a code of morals. If any of that stuff were sufficient, many of us would have recovered from alcoholism long ago. I kept trying to be better and I couldn't be better. I kept trying to do those things that you did and I couldn't do it. And I said to her, you know, when I was in LA, there was this guy who said I should read through the big book with another alcoholic. And I haven't tried that yet. She said, I would be honored. And I remember thinking, I didn't actually ask you. I mean, I didn't say it out loud, but I thought it. But I felt like I was trapped. And so I said, okay, all right. So I met with her every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. at her house. And I didn't know how arrogant I was, but I remember thinking, you know, this woman, I found out later, right, that she had just had a community college education. And I just thought, oh, I have multiple degrees. What are you going to teach me? And she said, I'm not going to teach you anything. That's not my job. My job is to read this book to you, and I will read it to you. You will not read it to me because you don't have anything I want. And I will read it to you, and I will explain to you what this means. And I just thought, whatever, Miss Community College, like, what can you, don't you know, I speak more than one language. Like, I've traveled the world. And she just said, yeah, okay. And she read to me the big book. And what the first thing that happened to me is when she read to me the doctor's opinion, there's a part in there that says their reliance upon things human fail them. Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I said, yes, that's me at 3.5 years of sobriety. I started seeing myself on those pages sober, and I was confused. And I said, I don't understand it. And she said, look, here's the thing. You don't have any idea what alcoholism is. first thing you have to understand is you have this physical allergy. If you're allergic to strawberries and you take a bite of a strawberry, you're going to break out in a rash. That's just how that is. And if you take a drink of alcohol, you are going to develop the phenomenon of craving. This, you can't close your eye. You can't take a bite of a strawberry and close your eyes and think real hard. I'm not going to have a rash. No, it just happens. It's the same thing with alcohol. And by this time, I had been around Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years. And I went, oh, that's what that means. I had no idea. In the rooms of AA for 10 years, no idea. Okay, I wasn't sober that whole time, so there's a little bit of excuse for that. But then she explained to me something that was more important. She explained to me what alcohol does for me. What alcohol does to me is the same thing alcohol does to everybody else. I drink too much, I get drunk, I slur my words, I fall down, I wake up in places I don't, as the thing I used to hear when I first came in. When I drank, I went places I didn't want to go with people I didn't want to be with and did things I didn't want to do. That's what alcohol did to me. But what alcohol did for me is described also in the Alcoholics, the doctor's opinion, where it says, we are restless, irritable, and discontent until we can experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that made sense to me. She told me I didn't fit in my own skin until I drank. And that again made sense to me. And I remember looking at her as she explained these things to me and being confused because she didn't look like an alcoholic. She was so happy. She was all together. Her life seemed easy. And I didn't understand how she could possibly know how I felt. But what she was telling me about her own life was the same thing that I was feeling. And as we moved through that first step, as she read this book to me, she pointed out things like, we have a solution upon which we can absolutely agree. We absolutely agree with it. And I can tell in a second if you absolutely agree with the same solution I have. When somebody shares in a meeting, I know you found the same solution. And I know that because this thing works if I do it. And I told my sponsor, I said, look, I've been here almost 4 years and 3.5 years sober. I've worked the steps. I don't think it's going to work. And she said, well, you don't have to think it's going to work and you don't have to believe it's going to work. You just have to do it and see what happens. And I was like, in my head, I'm like, fine, because I know everything, right? We have a saying in Polish. It sounds better in Polish, but I like it. It's like, God knows, but the alcoholic knows better. And that was me, right? I'm like, well, fine. I'm going to read this stupid book with you and do these stupid things you tell me to do. And then when we get to the end of it and nothing's better, I'm going to come back and tell you. Like, that was the whole point. I was like doing it out of resentment, out of I know better. But it didn't matter. So we started reading through these pages and, there's a part in I think it's on page 23. It's 23 or 24 in the English book. Page 23 in the English edition. And it says that the alcoholic has the inability to bring into his consciousness the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. He is without defense against the first drink. And when she read that to me, I got it. I have this disease of forgetting. I wake up in the morning going, I'm never going to drink again. I can't stand how I feel. And by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I think, I was overreacting a little bit. It wasn't that bad. I can drink just a little bit. I can't remember even how bad it was last night. And when she read that paragraph to me, we met for an hour and the hour was up and she read that paragraph and I drove away from that house. 3.5 years sober, knowing I was going to drink again. I knew it because I understood that. I understood that there were moments in my sobriety, this time that I wasn't drinking, when I was dying and had no solution. But in the back of my mind, every cell in my body knew that if I took a drink, even if it was for a second, no matter what the consequences were, I would feel better just for a second. And I was in so much pain and I was so sick, sober, that was in the back of my mind. Now, when I got back the next week, we read the next page, which says there is a solution, right? None of us like the leveling of pride, the searching of our shortcomings, you know, which the process requires for its successful consummation. She didn't, you know, try to sugarcoat any of this. She said, Sydney, these are not suggestions any more than we suggest you take a parachute when you jump out of a plane. This is what we do if you want what we have. And I wanted what she had. And I wanted freedom from the pain. I wanted freedom from the suffering. I wanted freedom from those bedevilments that she read to me on page 52. I was a prey to misery and depression. I couldn't control my emotional nature. I was unhappy. And she told me, that's alcoholism. That is what you're suffering from. And that is what I wanted a solution to. And what she read to me on page 45 was really important. She said, Sydney, look, lack of power, that's our dilemma. We have to find a power by which we can live, obviously. And it has to be a power greater than ourselves. But where and how to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. You don't have to solve your problem. We're going to put you in contact with some kind of higher power that does. And it's not the purpose of the book. The purpose of this book is to carry this message, to tell people precisely what we did, precisely what we did. And I was willing to do precisely what she did if I could get what she had, if I could get a second of freedom, because she promised me that if I work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they will do for me very, very slowly what alcohol did for me very, very quickly. And I wanted that. I wanted that freedom. Talked about freedom. That's what I wanted. But she also told me the main object of this work is to put me in contact with a higher power. That's why we're doing this. You know, it talks about that in the 10th step. It says we can use our willpower along these lines, all we wish. Along what lines? Thy will, not mine be done. That's what I need to use my willpower for, to seek God. And I had a problem with God. I was like, God, I don't know about God. I mean, I didn't have a problem with my church. I didn't have a problem with religion. It just seemed kind of dumb because, you know, I mean, the truth was I thought happy people were stupid because if they saw what life was like, they couldn't possibly be happy. They just must be dumb. Right. Yeah. And, but I had this thing with this God, like, okay, there's God. Sure, there's God. I mean, whatever. But how is it going to help me? And she said to me two things. The first thing, very important, was she said, Sydney, look, if we get to the 12th step, which says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, if you get there and you still have a problem with your higher power, we can have a conversation. And I said, okay. And she goes, the other thing is, Sydney, God knows who he is, and he does not need your help figuring it out. Let's just move on. And I was like, okay, I'm willing to do that too. And so we moved into the third step. And she pointed out to me, you know, I didn't know I was a drama queen. She would say, you're a drama queen. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm very stoic. I have no drama, right? But she pointed out what it says in step three, that we're in conflict with someone or something, even though our motives were good. And this last part of that sentence was so vital for me because my motives were always good. I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want to cause problems. I just wanted what was good and what was right. And I wanted to feel good and I wanted to do the right thing. I was the alcoholic that wanted to draw within the lines, and I couldn't figure out why I kept going out of the lines. I was cash register honest, right? And she said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your motives are. You know, if you're in conflict with something or somebody, you're running the show. And she told me that the third step to turn my will and my life was to turn my thinking and my actions over to the care of God as I understood him. And that made sense to me because I had already been reading pages 86, 87, 88 every morning that told me to ask God to direct my thinking. I could do that. It told me to pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the next right thought or action. I could do that too. So I got that. And what she pointed out to me set me free because I had a sponsor that told me when I went through the steps with her that I was supposed to, I had a long list of character defects. And she gave me a long list of the opposite character asset. And she told me to get on my knees every day and ask God to remove this defect of character and replace it with that asset of character. And I did that every day for 30 days and nothing changed. And when my sponsor explained to me what's written in step three that says we could be, our actor may be kind, patient, self-sacrificing. I mean, I thought that's how I was supposed to be. I kept trying to be that way. And I thought that was good until she pointed out to me that I was just doing that to manipulate everybody around me. If you don't do what I want, I'm going to be nicer. And then when you still don't do what I want, then I'm the victim. And you're a horrible person. You know what he did to me? Do you know what they did to me? I was just nice. I was just kind. And it still didn't work out. I'm doing all the right things. I didn't know I was trying. I didn't know I was that tornado. I didn't know that I was, obsessed with self. I had no idea. And what she said to me is she read that line that says we're a victim of the delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if we just manage well. And that I got it. I just kept trying to manage well. I believed if I got another degree, if I got a better job, if I had the right husband, if I had a kid, if I lived in a different country, then it would be okay. And it never, ever was. And so we got on our knees and held hands, which was weird and bizarre, and said the third step prayer, which made me feel super uncomfortable. I mean, this sponsor used to tell me, I love you. And I just thought, lady, God, bring it down. I could not handle it. It made me want to come out of my skin, really. Which is how some of my sponsees feel now. When I say, I love you. Like, whatever, crazy lady. But she said to me, this third step, it was vital and it was important, but it could have little lasting effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that were blocking me. And I didn't know that's what the fourth step was. I had no idea that I was supposed to get down to the causes and conditions. She pointed out to me once again that liquor was just a symptom. It was just a symptom. That wasn't really my problem. My problem was, remember that power we talked about? You're blocked off from that power. You need a new power. You need to clear away all that wreckage and have something come through you to solve your problems and to make life easy. And I wanted that. And it changed how I looked at the fourth step. Now, this woman was not my sponsor to this point. And I remember getting to the point of the fourth step and I said, would you be willing to hear my fifth step? And she said, yes, of course. And I don't remember when I asked her to sponsor me, but at some point I did. And she did become my sponsor. But what she told me about the fourth step, which was so crucial, is that this is a fact-finding and fact-facing mission. I don't care about your details. They're not important. And that was such good news for me because I had a sponsor who told me after I read my fifth step to her that I needed more stuff on it. So I went home and I made stuff up because I'm like, I don't have any more stuff, but okay, how about this? And so she's like, I don't care about your details. I don't care. We're gonna write a list. Because it says in the book to write a list, when you go to the grocery store, you write a grocery list. You don't write a grocery story. So who you're resentful at and five words or less, what it is. And I did that. And when we went through the first list, the resentment list, the defect of character that came out of that was that I was afraid I wasn't enough, that I was walking around comparing myself all the time to you. I was either better than or I was less than. And I just had my yardstick out, measuring it up. I mean, that still shows up for me today. Not as bad, but I mean, the example that was such a great example was the 10 items or less aisle at the grocery store, right? Like I show up, I've got 10 items and you have 12. And now I'm mad because you're in my way. And you have 12. I'm not in a hurry. I don't have anywhere to go, but you have 12 items and it says 10. And so I'm better than you. Right. And I went through that whole list. And what I found out that first list was the resentment list was just me going back through my life, looking for all the places I wasn't enough. I mean, that was it. I wasn't enough here. I wasn't enough here. I wasn't enough there because I don't really remember the places where I was enough. And if you harmed me, well, then I was better than you. Right. If I was justifiably hurt and it really was your fault, then I was better than you. And what my sponsor said is it doesn't matter who's at fault. The wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, actually has the power to kill. You need to find a way to live without that. Doesn't matter who's at fault. Doesn't matter who's responsible. Finding a way to be free of that is what's important here. And that these wrongdoings these other people had done to me were just symptoms of their spiritual malady, that I was just like them, that I was driven by this fear of not being good enough, just like they were, that I was driven by the fear of what other people thought of me, just like they were, that I was driven by this self-obsession, just like they were, and that I didn't trust my higher power, just like them. And those are the four defects of character that came out of my fourth step, out of my fears inventory. You know, so wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? That's why I had that fear, because I knew on my own, I couldn't do it. And she said, well, we have a better way, right? Higher power, trust and reliance on a higher power. And what happened for me in the fifth step, there were two things, two great spiritual experiences, which at the time I wouldn't have told you was a spiritual experience at all, but I know they were. The first thing was when she read to me the line in the fifth step out of the big book that says, to this point, we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. I understood that something had happened. I understood. I couldn't tell you when it happened, but I knew that I had had a spiritual experience. And it's what it talks about in the appendix, right? I had undergone a profound alteration in my reaction to life, and I could not have brought that about by myself alone. And it happened over a very short period of time, just a few months. The other thing was I went home after my sex inventory. And I felt horrible. I had a migraine. I felt sick because I looked at that list and I was so sad for that woman who was going around just looking for someone to love her, just looking for God, really. Because what I found on that sex inventory was if you loved me and you thought I was great, then I was. And if you didn't and you thought I wasn't, then I wasn't. And my sponsor said to me, Sydney, that which you are seeking from all these people is what you must be seeking from God. God can give you that, not these people. You're just using them to make yourself feel better. And I went home that night and I felt so sad and I went to sleep and the most miraculous thing happened. I fell asleep and I didn't wake up till morning. And I had never had that experience in my entire life without drugs or alcohol. I did not know that was possible. And what she explained to me is that is God working in my life. That is the freedom that we get from these steps. And even today, if I wake up in the middle of the night worrying about something, I know there's something wrong with my spiritual condition. And we moved into the sixth and seventh step. And she said, Sydney, you know, keep in mind that every single one of these defects of character has two sides. If I want you to like me and I'm afraid that you don't, you know, I want God to remove the part where you don't like me, but I want to keep the part where everybody thinks I'm great and you think I'm super and we're all friends and oh, we love Sydney. Like, I want to keep that part. And she said, no, you got to give both parts to God, right? He can have the good and the bad. And the sixth step for me, even today, is the most difficult step. It's the key for me. Because in the sixth step, I am confronted with these old ideas. That's where they start to show up. they start to show up that if you don't like me, then I'm not enough, or I'm not going to be happy. I was going to get married a couple years ago, and about a year and a half ago, he decided he didn't want to marry me. And in the sixth step is where I started seeing things like, oh, I think I have to be married to be okay. You know, these old ideas that, well, actually what it is, it's the broccoli God. I call it as the broccoli. This is what I think about God. This is why I don't trust God, because I'm going to ask God for something and he's going to say, yes, you can have broccoli because it's healthy and it's good for you. But I want chocolate cake. But if I really turn everything over to him, I'm just going to get this healthy broccoli and chicken. And, you know, I'm not going to get to go to the Mexican food place and have the, you know, flan, right? Like, no, you're going to get broccoli and no sugar for you ever again, because it's not good for you. Like, and that's really what I believe about God. And that's where it shows up, is in my sixth step. So I told her, okay, I'm willing to do it. And she goes, even if you're not, it's okay, Sydney. Just ask God for the willingness and the readiness, you know, that God give you the complete readiness. And I said, okay, I'm probably saying that wrong in English. I have it in my, Dajmy gotowość. I don't know why I have it in my head in Polish for some reason right now. But I did that, and I asked to be ready, and I asked to be willing, and I did the seventh step prayer. And she pointed out to me that also, you know, I don't know what's good and bad. I don't have any idea of what God wants for me or doesn't want for me. And it's really not my business, any more than my life is not my business. If I have really turned my will and my life over the care of God as I understand him, it is no longer any of my business. It's God's business. And I don't know what's good or bad, so I have to give him everything and let him decide, which I thought was a bad idea. I'm like, I don't know about that. Come on. And she also told me that the result of the seventh step and the steps to this point was that I was now going to be a maximum use to God and those about me. And I thought, what about me? Right? What about me? She goes, it will bring you joy like you've never experienced. And about this time in my sobriety, as I was moving into 8 and 9 and starting to do that work, people started asking me to sponsor them. And I started giving them my sponsor's phone number. So I'm like, oh, no, call her. She's like a magician. She's awesome. She'll save your life, you know. And my sponsor called me. She's like, knock it off. Say yes. Say yes. And I said, but I don't know how. She goes, you don't need to know how. You don't need to know anything. That's good news. Remember, you're not important. All you need to do is have this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and do exactly what I did with you. And so I started saying yes, and I started reading the big book with other alcoholics. When we got to the 10th step, well, the 9th step, right? She laid out a set of spiritual principles, which I was supposed to live by. No criticizing, no arguing, no pointing out what was wrong with you. And not only in while making my amends, but while I live, right? She also told me not to be scraping or servile, that as God's child, I stand on my own feet. And that one was almost harder for me, because my self-centeredness shows up like it's all my fault. It's all my fault. And if I do this better or do that better, then everybody will be happy. If I'm just more this or that, you know. And what she pointed out is that's just insane self-centeredness, because really what I want is you to be happy so that I can feel okay. Right? Like, I don't really want what's best for you. I just want you to stop talking to me that way, you know, or stop screaming or whatever it is. And so I did my 9th step, and yes, the freedom came. And she told me, look, here's the truth. You have to work your 10th step every single day. And the 10th step is the practical application of steps 1 through 9. Because the promise of the 10th step is the exact opposite of what's happening in the 3rd step. The 3rd step says, I'm in constant conflict with something or somebody. And the 10th step says, I have ceased fighting anyone or anything, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. And that was the key for me, sanity. She told me insanity is the simple inability to see the truth. And I knew there was something wrong with my mind and how I perceived things. But by the 10th step, I had stopped fighting. I was placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And the way that would continue to happen, my problems are removed. They don't exist for me. You know, I don't have problems today. God has problems. That's his business, right? And that's what happens in the 10 steps, so long as I continue to do the spiritual work. And she was very clear, the spiritual work is not me going through the steps over and over and over and over again with her, reading the big book over and over and over again with her, and working on myself. It was to go out and carry this message to others and read the big book with them. When I asked her to, when I ran into a problem later on in my life and I asked her to do some work with me again in the book, she said, no, get busy helping others. Right? And that's the constant message of all of my sponsors today. My sponsor today, when I call him, I'm like, oh, I've got this problem. He's like, you need more AA, Sydney. More AA. Like, I don't think I need more AA. Really, I don't. I do a lot of AA. He's like, well, you need a little bit more. You know, your problem is, Sydney, your problem is you just don't have enough time to sit around and think about yourself. That's your problem. I'm like, oh, God, you're right. You know? And so the 11th step is not the 10th step. The nightly review that says, you know, I look for where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. That is not the 10th step. That is the 11th step. If I have done my 10th step throughout the day, I already know the answers to all those questions. The question that comes out of the 11th step is, where is God in this? Am I letting him run my life? Am I feeling that power coming through? If not, these things start to crop up. That's where I'm blocked off from God. And I ask God to direct my thinking, to take my life. It's no longer my business. And then, of course, this is not an 11-step program. It's a 12-step program. I have to work the 12 step. And I do that. I have a lot of sponsees. And what do I do with my sponsees? Exactly the same thing that I just told you I did with my sponsor. Exactly. And the reason why is because I don't know anything else. You know, when it comes to technical stuff, right, the way I did the 5th step, 2 columns and the 3rd column then we did together. I am a 3 column person. That's how many are in the book, right? But you know what I did? I did the resentment inventory, then the sex inventory, and then the fears inventory. That's backwards. That's not how it's written in the book. But guess what? That's what saved my life. That's what worked for me. And if I start changing that around because I think I know better, oh, I'm 24 years sober now. I know a little bit more. That's just guesswork. And these women and men who I sponsor, their life is far too important for me to guess what might be good for them. So I do exactly what's written in the book as far as it was done with me. And we read through the book and every day I have a new experience. I have a new experience with you. I talked to a couple of sponsees today who were like, this sponsee, this, and that sponsee, that. And I'm like, yay. Because when we have trouble with sponsees, that's us. If I'm disturbed, there is something wrong with me. That sponsee is doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Right? And who am I to judge? It took me 7 years to get to Alcoholics Anonymous and another 3 to work the stupid steps. I mean, come on. Like, oh, look at me. I'm a super over high achiever, right? 10 years before I worked my first step, really, if I'm honest about it. And then I continue working that first step as I go around. You know, last year I had to change sponsors after my breakup. My sponsor that I had, she was in and out of the hospital. Her husband was in and out of the hospital. COVID hit. I couldn't get a hold of her. And another woman that I knew, I asked to help me with the steps. And I walked through the steps 3 times with her. And at the end of that time, I asked her to work with me. And she didn't, you know, she said that we could walk together, but she has a lot of sponsees. And I respected that. And I just happened to call this person that I knew from AA and who I'd been in contact with and asked. And this guy said, oh my God, yes, that's great. Well, are you sponsorable? Like, you know? And it made me feel again on fire. And I am now very privileged to be part of this group of alcoholics who are enthusiastic about this program, who work with sponsees, who work on all parts of, you know, they're in service. They're active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's my lifeline right now. I moved back to Poland last July. And we have one meeting in English here. And when I first moved here 10 years ago, I went to that meeting and I thought, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be great. I'm living in Poland. I walk into this meeting and there's 2 guys there. One's a week sober and the other guy was drunk. And I was like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. And so I had to learn how to speak Polish. I did not speak Polish when I moved here 10 years ago. I do speak Polish now. And I speak Polish because I started reading through the Big Book in Polish with sponsees. And we ended up having to do a new translation of the Big Book. Because I'll tell you what I know here and what I learned at 14 years sobriety is the truth that I learned when I was 4 years sobriety, that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous carries the message that we all agree on. And when we do these things as they're written in the book, we experience a freedom beyond our wildest dreams. Because when I got here, I was the old timer with 14 years sober. I was the old timer. There were a few people here and there who had more sobriety than me. And I was shocked and astounded. And I wasn't ready to be the old timer in the room. What's happened since the Big Book has been published is people are staying sober longer. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous carrying the message throughout the world. And I am delighted. I get to now work with a sponsee in Iran, right? And the women there, we're on fire. AA is on fire here in Poland. We're just doing the deal, right? And it's exciting. It's exciting. And what I know now at this point in my sobriety is that when I went through that breakup when I was 3 years sober, I didn't know it was going to be okay. And when I went through a breakup a year and a half ago, I knew it was going to be okay. I didn't like it, but I have never had to experience the darkness that I felt the first time I went through the steps, because I know this works. And if it works for me, I think it could probably work for you too. That's been my experience. So I am grateful to have been asked to speak here today. I'm willing to always show up for Alcoholics Anonymous any time of day or night. And I do. And I don't do it because, oh, you know, look at me. I do it because you guys gave me my life. I didn't have anything of a life until I came here. And I am willing to go to the ends of the earth for this thing still today. So thank you.